Yesterday morning, Dr. White talked about taking risks in ministry. I'm here to tell you he's a man who practices what he preaches. He asked me to speak in chapel. Dr. Dixon took that risk 20 years ago, and I have a clip here to show you how that turned out.
Illustration Paul says I can think of that is the illustration of a mother providing for her child. Now, did you notice in the middle of this there's a reference to joy? Jesus says in verse 11, "These things am I writing to you, that my joy might be in you and that your joy might be full." Well, how can we visualize that and imagine what it is to have fullness of joy, even if we've ever had it? Let's suppose that joy is something that fills something like this, a cup. What's the degree of joy I might find in my cup? Would it be half full? Quarter full? Is there enough to see if there's anything on the bottom? Is there anything at all? Whoa! Well, that'll be memorable. You won't forget this message. There it is. All my joy.
You see the risk that we run this morning. I've not brought along an object lessons, so you're safe from flying glass or cups or anything that might happen along that line. I probably ought to straighten out a misconception among some students as well, and that is that Dr. Murdoch and I were not present when the college was chartered in 1887. So that's a plug for students to sign up for more history courses. The founders of Cedarville College, as it was called back then, could not have imagined what you see and experience today. The facilities on these 100 or so acres, 4,500 students, multiple programs and faculties to staff those programs. This would have been beyond their wildest imagination. They couldn't even begun to dream this. What they faced instead was significant challenges and trials and difficulties. And there were often times when it didn't look too bright. Didn't it look too bright to begin with? The college was chartered in 1887, which meant now they could start offering classes and welcoming students, but they weren't ready for that. It took 7 years to get enough faculty to be able to open doors and facilities to begin offering classes in 1894. In the early part of the 20th century, things went fairly well, but then the Depression hit. Student enrollment plunged. Folks didn't have money to pay for college. The college began incurring debt. That debt continued to accumulate after the Great Depression into the 40s. In the early 1950s, finally came time that the college was just going to go under. They just couldn't survive any longer. James T. Jeremiah was a pastor of Emmanuel Baptist Church in Dayton at that time and heard that basically the college and its property was being offered free to anyone who would take it. Now, free in a sense, because the land and the building or so that was there for someone who wanted it, but one also had to accept the indebtedness, which in 1953 was some $50,000. In today's economy, that's about $500,000. James C. Jeremiah and the men that he put together who agreed to take over that responsibility didn't have anywhere near $500,000 in our economy. So they faced additional challenges and difficulties, and what the Bible calls trials. In the first year or so, it didn't look like it was going to make it. The first few years, people thought that James T. Jeremiah was on a fool's mission. I'd like to look at a couple of Old Testament characters with you this morning who also faced some challenges, some difficulties, things that appeared to be really humanly insurmountable. And just observe how they faced those. Find your way back in the Old Testament, tucked away in the book of 2 Chronicles, chapter 14. reference to one of the good kings of Judah. The kingdom is divided by this time, the northern kingdom Israel, the southern kingdom Judah. Here we have an account out of the life and ministry of Asa, King Asa. And I'll pick up here with in chapter 14 with the second verse of 2 Chronicles chapter 14. Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. Just a reminder that the eyes of the Lord look down upon all in his all-knowing vision, and he assesses and evaluates every individual's life. Here's his assessment of Asa's. For he removed the altars of the foreign gods in the high places, broke down the sacred pillars and cut down the wooden images. He commanded Judah to seek the Lord, of God of their fathers, to observe the law and the commandment. He also removed the high places and the incense altars from the cities of Judah, and the kingdom was quiet under him. And he built fortified cities in Judah, for the land had rest. He had no war in those years, because the Lord had given him rest. Therefore he said to Judah, let us build these cities and make walls around them, towers, gates, and bars, while the land is yet before us, because we have sought the Lord our God. We have sought him, and he has given us rest on every side. So they built and prospered. And Asa had an army of 300,000 from Judah who carried shields and spears, and from Benjamin, 280,000 men who carried shields and drew bows. All these were mighty men of valor. Then Zerah the Ethiopian came against them with an army of 1,000,000 men and 300 chariots, and he came to Mareshah. Many commentators believe that comment, 1,000,000 men, is not necessarily a head count, but in essence what he had was just an innumerable host of military men. He was in essence going to clean up everybody who got in his way. Next to this kind of a humongous horde of fortified men with 300 chariots, humanly speaking, Judah didn't stand a chance, and Asa knew it. So now in verse 10, Asa went out against him, and they set the troops in battle in array in the valley of Zarephath of Mareshah. Now Asa calls upon the Lord, and notice that his call isn't some irrational, emotional plea for help. And notice that he doesn't respond with saying, why does God do this to me? I've been righteous. I've been good. I've rooted the idolatry out of the country. I've tried to live a godly life. And now look what happens. Look what God runs and lets come into my life. Asa doesn't respond that way. That's not how Asa looks at his predicament. Notice what he says here in verse 11. Asa cried out to the Lord his God and said, Lord, it's nothing for you to help, whether with many or with those who have no power. He begins with theology. He begins acknowledging who his God is, acknowledges him as the sovereign God, but he even extends that. He just doesn't say you're the sovereign God who's in control of everything. He says, it makes no difference to you whether to deliver with many or with just a few, because right now we are just a few. How Asa sized up the situation was simply this, that God was not conditioned to the size of Asa's army and his resources, which were paltry compared to that horde of Ethiopians that was about ready to come in and clean them up. He recognized that small in his sight was not small in God's sight. And their smallness and their insignificance had no difference as to how God was going to resolve the situation. God was not limited by their small, insignificant, paltry size compared to this giant horde of military men that was about ready to wipe them off the map. He continues, O Lord, help us, O Lord our God, for we rest in you. We were told earlier that he'd had rest in the land. Now he appeals again that they might have rest. Now what he means by that I suggest to you, is not that they just remain passive. Que sera, sera, there's nothing we can do about it anyhow. Let's just let whatever happens happen. The rest that he's talking about is not being passive. Asa is very aggressive. He's determined, he's steadfast to develop and practice a right view of God. He's steadfast and tenacious in holding correct theology and a right view of who God is, where he is in his circumstance, and how God is going to deal with that. So enable us to continue to enjoy your blessing and your rest. Now notice how he continues. And in your name, we go out against this multitude, O Lord. You are our God. Do not let man prevail against who? Notice he doesn't say, don't let him prevail against us. Don't let him destroy our wives and children, steal our land, torture us and put us to death. He says, don't let that army prevail against you. Do you get a little idea of Asa's worldview? Asa recognizes that it's God's name and God's reputation that's at stake in this conflict. Asa is in essence saying to God, Lord, if the Ethiopians come in here and clean us out, all the peoples around us are going to get a false impression of you. They're going to believe that you're not powerful enough and great enough and mighty enough to protect and care for your own people. More than his own skin, more than his own property, Asa's concerned about the reputation of God and what a defeat at the hand of the Ethiopians is going to do in terms of people's impression of the God of Israel. So how does God respond to that kind of a request? Well, look at verse 12. So the Lord struck the Ethiopians before Asa and Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. And Asa and the people who were with him pursued them to Gerar. So the Ethiopians were overthrown, and they could not recover, for they were broken before the Lord and his army. And they carried away much, very much spoil. Then they defeated all the cities around Gerar, for the fear of the Lord came upon them, and they plundered all the cities, for there was exceedingly much spoil in them. They also attacked the livestock enclosures, carried off sheep and camels in abundance, and returned to Jerusalem. Well, that's how Asa sized up the situation. Let me just point out one more Old Testament example. It's back in 1 Samuel. It's 1 Samuel 17. This is the account of David and Goliath. You ever remember the day you didn't know about David and Goliath? First time you ever heard of it? Most of us feel like we were born with that in our minds. I just want to pick out a couple of sections through here. But I want to preface it by saying that David comes into this situation able at a young age. Scholars tell us probably younger than about any of us here. And he was able to size up the situation as no one else could and did. And he addressed three audiences. He addressed his brothers and their fellow military men. He addressed Saul and he addressed Goliath. And none of them could figure out what was going on. And David somehow did the best he could. They just didn't get it, okay? Okay, let's pick up with verse 8. In 1 Samuel 17. Then he stood, this is the he Goliath, stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you'll become our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Okay, let's skip ahead a little bit. You'll recall, of course, David's father Jesse had sent him to the army to take food supplies and other things to his three older brothers who were there in the military. And so David arrived with those possessions, not really aware yet of what was going on, but it suddenly struck him in a way that no one could miss. Picking up at verse 23. Then as he talked with them, David, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke according to the same words, so David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the men, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. So the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches, will give him his daughter, and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel. Then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Do you see David's perspective? Did you catch the earlier perspective? Did you catch Goliath's perspective? Back in verse 10, he says, I defy the armies of the living God this day. The army of Israel, the Israelites said, have you seen this man who's come up? Surely he has come to defy Israel. David looks at it differently. David says, who has allowed this uncircumcised Philistine to come and defy the armies of the living God? Do you see what he's saying? The issue isn't Goliath versus Israel. The issue is Goliath versus God. Why doesn't someone go out there and take care of him? What is going on around here? How come you guys have sat around here petrified, listening to that goon for 40 days? Doesn't have anything to do with the honor of God? Doesn't have anything to do with him? Doesn't have anything to do with why we exist as a people? Doesn't anybody see what's going on? No, okay? So the word gets around, and then he's ushered into the presence of the king. Go on down to verse 31. Now when the words of David, when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for him. Then David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go out and fight with this Philistine. Let me just pause here and say, let me suggest to you, if I understand David correctly, what he is saying is, the situation is such that all that's required is for someone to go out in the name of the true and living God and simply confront the giant. And if I understand David correctly, what he's saying is, anybody could have done that. You could have. The situation was such that God set it up, so it was simply necessary for someone to represent and stand in the name and for the honor and reputation, like Asa was concerned about, for the true and living God, whose reputation didn't look very good in light of the situation there at that particular time. Saul responds in verse 33 to David, you're not able to go out against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are a youth and he's a man of war. How does Saul size up the situation? Well, Saul sizes up the situation, it's Goliath against you, David, and you're going to be mincemeat. You're done. David said, it's not me against the Goliath. It's Goliath against God. Let me give you an illustration. So David said to Saul, your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by the beard and struck it and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them. Why? Seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. What is David saying? David's saying, I was stuck back on the back 40 somewhere out in the pasture, doing about the lowliest job that could be done. There is no status associated with being a shepherd, okay? You're on the low rung of the status ladder in that situation, okay? And so I was out there, and I was out there before nobody, looking after animals, some of the dumbest animals around, and just looking after them. But there was planet. I recognized that those animals were not my animals. They weren't even my father's sheep. They were God's sheep. And that's the way I went approach that. And so when a lion and a bear came along, I stood between those sheep and that lion and the bear, and I took that animal on. I took it on in the name of God because there were God's sheep I was taking care of. There was no audience. There was nobody to impress. But David had cultivated it in his mind that whatever he was given, it was a stewardship of ultimately God's property, God's talents, God's ownership. And so he was going to defend that, because tied into that was God's honor and God's reputation. Well, notice that David says, "The Lord who has delivered me," in verse 37, "from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine." And Saul said, "Go, the Lord be with you." Okay. Notice Saul doesn't go. Okay. Saul doesn't still doesn't see it as Goliath against God. Saul sees it as Goliath against me, and I'm not going to take that on. If you want to do that, be that crazy, go ahead, kid. Now let's go on down to the valley. Verse 41. Here's the confrontation between David and Goliath. "So the Philistine came and began drawing near to David, and the man who bore the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and good-looking. So the Philistine said to David, 'Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?' And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, 'Come to me, and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field.' Then David said to the Philistine, 'You come to me with sword and with spear and with javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied.'" Now he says what's going on to Goliath, who doesn't see it either, okay? But the point is, in David's mind is the concept that whatever he's doing, whatever task God has given to him, he's going to carry it out in light of God's honor, God's name, and God's respect, in order to do what? To glorify him. That's what we're about, isn't it? To glorify him. Well, he continues here then in verse 46, "This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. This day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all the assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." David understood that the battle was ultimately God's. It was God's battle. It was God risking his, if you will, reputation and his name. That's where David stood. Now, I want to tell you that both David and Asa are made out of the same stuff as you and I, which means that later down the road of life, each of them failed miserably. You're familiar with the adultery and the murder of David and Bathsheba. When Nathan confronted him in 2 Samuel 12, he said to him, "You have caused the enemies of Israel to blaspheme God." What he's saying there in essence is, the neighboring nations who are looking on, and you, the chief representative of the God on this part of the planet, what you do apparently represents what God approves of. And you have misrepresented God as one who approves of adultery. That's blaspheming. That's misrepresenting the true and living God. The fact of the matter is, the nations around them, the heathen nations around them with their pagan religions, the majority of them didn't even believe it was right to have adultery with another man's wife. Even they disapproved of that. So, and Nathan is saying, in essence, as God looks, as the nations look on, David, they're seeing God, our God, is approving of what you just did. God can't let that go. What about Asa? Back to 2 Corinthians, Chronicles, chapter 16. We look ahead a few years, and I'm just interested in verses 7 through 9 in Asa's future. Here, picking up with verse 7. At the time, Hanani the seer came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, because you have relied on the king of Syria and have not relied on the Lord your God, therefore the army of the king of Syria has escaped from your hand. Were the Ethiopians and the Lubim not a huge army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand. I'm interested in the next verse. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. I suggest the same eyes are looking around in this group, on our planet. God's seeking out those whose hearts are loyal toward him, whose hearts and lives and minds understand that we're in something bigger than just an interest in ourselves. God has invested more than just us. There's more invested in us than just ourselves. Do you know what he's invested in you and me as the people of God? He's invested his name, his honor, his reputation, so that when trials hit and difficulties arise and I'm under pressure, okay, the way in which I respond to that is going to say something about the God I serve. What's a common metaphor used in the Bible to describe the people of God? Well, in Psalm 100, we're told, we are his people, the sheep of his pasture. Sheep. Not mules, not oxen, not camels, not horses. Those are beasts of burden. Those are beasts who can carry heavy loads. Sheep are not beasts of burden. Sheep were not made and equipped to carry burdens. You see, what you and I have done time and again is that as God has sent the Goliaths and the Ethiopians into your life and mine, we've kind of looked at them as if it was them against us. We've missed the whole scene. We've missed the whole situation. We've missed what's really going on. If you and I have been commissioned by the true living God, and whatever we're going into, we're going out into his work, and we're here as his, as students and professors on his mission, then when we face challenges and difficulties and problems and what the Bible calls trials, it's the opportunity to recognize that this is ultimately God's battle and God's issue and God's concern. He simply asked us to remain tenacious in terms of our consistent, right conceptions of who he is, what he's able to do, and not understanding all the situation and how it's going to turn out, leave the results to him. And live in such a way that God is honored and others see just a little bit of him through us. Well, that's not the way I tend to live and tend to think, but you and I have been given the privilege to live in such a way as reflects either positively or negatively on the honor of the God who's called us and saved us and even given his son on our behalf. You and I have the opportunity then to reflect his ownership of us and ownership of everything we have and are, and to live in such a way that as we face challenges and difficulties, which we do, and which we are right now, many of us, we probably need to come to the point to realize that some of us are bearing burdens that we have no business bearing. His call, remember, to the crowd was, come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy burdened down. My yoke is easy, my burden is light, okay? I may need to have to reassess what I'm doing, what this is all about. Yeah, assignments are tough. Deadlines come quick. There are other issues. Who enjoys COVID and wearing masks and all the rest of that? But ultimately, if we've been placed here by God, then the ultimate concern and the ultimate issue and the ultimate burden bearing is his. You and I have the honor and privilege of living faithfully, righteously, representing the God who is truth and holiness and love to sinners such as you and I, that by his grace, he might communicate to others his glory through the choices and lifestyles of you and me. Let's look to him in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the pictures of individuals made out of the same stuff as us, Asa and David on two different occasions. We're able to size up situations rather than being overwhelmed and crushed by the Goliaths that you brought into their lives. Lord, you bring those into our lives from time to time. We all have faced them or will face them. Some of us are facing them now. Help us to get a right biblical perspective on just who is ultimately at risk here in terms of reputation and honor. Enable us to live in such a way that you are glorified and exalted through our lifestyles and our handling, particularly of challenges and pressures and burdens, for Christ's glory and sake. Amen. You are dismissed.